From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, late night's Conan O'Brien. 3 years ago, he took over the show. Since then, he's gotten rid of the pompadour and developed his own brand of late night absurdity. Before that, O'Brien was a writer with Saturday Night Live and The Simpsons. Also, The Confessions of a Foot Fetishist. We talk with British writer Jeff Nicholson, whose new comic novel, Footsucker, is told from the point of view of a man obsessed with women's feet. One of Nichols' previous novels was about men obsessed with collecting old Volkswagens. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Fresh Air support comes from Morrow, publishers of the new autobiography Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 3 years ago, when Conan O'Brien took David Letterman's spot on Late Night, critics and audiences were skeptical that he'd last. After all, O'Brien had made his reputation as a writer, not a performer. He wrote for The Simpsons, Saturday Night Live, and in his college days was president of the Harvard Lampoon. And he didn't seem all that comfortable in front of the camera. But O'Brien has not only held his spot on Late Night, he's developed his own style and has caught on. Here's an excerpt of last night's opening monologue.
A lot was made of the fact, folks, that the Yankee manager Joe Torre's sister is a nun and Catholic school principal, and she had all her students praying for a Yankee victory. Well, we were wondering what this was all about, so we sent a camera crew down to record the daily prayer, see what it was like. Take a look.
Children, repeat after me. Dear Lord, we pray that the Yankees will win the World Series.
Dear Lord, we pray that the Yankees will win the World Series.
We also beseech you.
We also beseech you.
To cast the heathen Atlanta Braves into the deepest hellfire. Amen.
Cast the heathen Atlanta Braves into the hellfire.
Amen.
I like how children naturally resist evil.
Conan O'Brien also does a lot of absurd satires. Some of the most absurd feature Conan O'Brien as a kind of action hero with guns blazing.
We do a piece that we call New Directors, and it's a piece where basically we come back from a commercial and I say, ladies and gentlemen, we have a wonderful director on our show, Liz Polanka, a terrific woman who does a great job, but it took us a while to find her. And in that period when we were looking, we tried out many different directors. And this is basically just an excuse for us to do a genre parody where we then say, we tried out one director who was really famous for his blaxploitation films in the early 70s, and then we'll cut to how that director did the show, and it'll be very absurd. Andy and I will be played by two black people, and you'll hear that kind of wonka chunka 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 wonka chunka 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 bass playing in the background, and you know, we'll start the two black actors will start talking about how someone's moving in on their territory uptown, and then they'll run out of the building, and you'll cut to bad 70s footage of running gun battles, and at the same time, we'll say, we tried someone out who had kind of he was a young student of Sam Peckinpah, and then we'll cut to, me and Andy basically, having a huge running gun battle, and then we'll really use guns and we'll use exploding squibs so it looks like we're shooting each other. We'll shoot it a lot like an action movie, and then suddenly when the action dies down, I'll introduce my first guest tonight is Al Roker, and it bleeds into a talk show. So we've done things like that where I think people get a lot of bang for their buck.
Well, what makes it also particularly funny, too, is that you're so not the action hero. You know what I mean? There's no way you'd be like the muscular leading man in
now,
the action.
Now, why would you say something like that? That's not how I see myself at all. That's wow. You're the first. I have a bunch of people around me who always just say, "Conan, that's how people see you." And then I come on National Public Radio and have my delusions popped right here in front of everybody.
It's cool.
I think that brings up an important element of the show is a lot of my sense of humor, and this isn't a moral choice or anything, but my sense of humor since I was 5 years old has been a lot of times to make fun of myself or to find myself absurd. And so we'll write a lot of pieces where, it is my attempt to play the hunky action hero that's the joke, or it's my it's the fact that the joke is basically that it's me. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And that I'm not, the professional 11:30 talk show host, that I'm the guy who's on at 12:30 who probably looks a little young to be having one of these shows, and for the first two seasons my suits were ill-fitting, and do you know what I mean? We sort of exploit that kid who's dressing up like an adult doing a show with his pal.
Conan O'Brien is my guest. When you started doing Late Night, you didn't have a lot of experience as the person on stage at the microphone. You were the behind-the-scenes writer for most of your experiences. Did you have any sense of how you would look on TV?
I didn't have a sense of how I would look on TV as much as the best sense I had is how I would be in front of an audience, because for years, starting in 1985, I had been working on stage as an improviser, as an improvisational performer in sketches, doing sketch comedy in front of audiences. I had done a stage show in Chicago. And, at the time, it made a much more dramatic story to say, this guy's a writer. He's never been a performer. In fact, he doesn't want to be a performer. He's being forced to do this by the government. It made the whole story much more compelling. But the truth is, I had not had TV experience, but I had had the whole reason that I was confident was that I knew what I would be like in front of people. I knew what I would be like in front of an audience, and I knew that if we had a live studio audience, which we do, we have about 210 people in the audience. I knew that I could sort of come alive in front of people, and I'd always been that way, and as far as what I would look like on TV, I really didn't have that great a sense. I had done some TV work, and so I had kind of an idea, but certainly I'd never seen myself that much on television.
So when the show was first on the air, did you watch yourself every night to get a sense of was working and what wasn't?
Yeah, I did. And once I got over the shock at just how fat my Irish head was, which it took about a month to recover from, I then started to you just make adjustments. That's what these shows are.
What adjustments did you make?
Well, you made a ton of adjustments. A lot of them visual adjustments. Okay, the lighting's all wrong. I'm wearing too much makeup. I look orange. My hair. I don't know if anyone, if your viewers remember, but my hair for the first 6 months. Was very high. I'm a big rockabilly fan, so I used to kind of got into the habit of combing my hair up and out, like Eddie Cochran or something. And so for the first 6 months of the show, I had this giant pompadour that was knocking Klieg lights out in the studio. I mean, it was just this huge giant pompadour. So and that was frightening viewers. So I comb my hair down a bit. So you make small changes like that, and then you make a million adjustments in terms of what comedy works and what doesn't work. We used to do comedy during the interviews. I'd be talking to a guest like Mary Tyler Moore, and then I'd have her participate in a piece of comedy and then continue with the interview. And it just didn't work. It just was jarring and uncomfortable. And so we learned, we phased that out. And whenever a sketch would really work, I'd examine, why did that work so well? Why was I so good in that? Why did that feel so good? And you'd try and learn from that and say, okay, let's increase the number of sketches like that we do. Let's decrease. And that process still goes on today. I look at early shows now. I mean, we're only talking, We're talking 3 years ago, which in most people's lives, I mean, most of the people listening right now think, oh, Conan O'Brien, yeah, he's that new guy. To them, 3 years isn't that long. When I pop in a tape of an early episode now, it's like looking at a kinescope of early television because I look completely different. Uh-huh. My relationship with Andy is very stiff and formal, and the suits are too tight, and my voice is at a different register, and some of the sketches I think still today I think are brilliant and great. And I think there's a lot about the show early on that I think the reason we're on the air is that there was a lot early on that was very good. But there was also stuff that was just insanely, what the hell were we thinking?
When you were writing on Saturday Night Live or for The Simpsons, did you ever think, I should be in front of the camera. I'm at least as good as these guys I'm writing for.
I never thought when I was working on Saturday, I always wanted to perform and I wanted to be someone who was in front of the camera because I knew that I had some facility for that and I wanted to do it. But I never, when I was working at Saturday Night Live, I knew that, you know, first of all, I was writing for people like Dana Carvey and John Lovitz, and they're just, you know, much better sketch players than I am. They're 100 times better. You know, I don't do impressions. I don't have nearly the range that they have as performers. They were doing something that I did not really aspire to and that I knew deep down, that's not really what I do. I'm not, you know, I don't have like a ton of characters like the church lady or Hans and Franz. So when I was writing for them, I never thought I could do what they do better. I wasn't that stupid. And when I was at The Simpsons, everyone I was working for was a brilliant voiceover artist. These people were really great actors who could create these characters, these voices alone that would bring a character to life. And I knew, well, I can't do that. I don't have a good voice. I have the voice of a 14-year-old boy, you know. So I didn't think I could do better than them. Instead, I knew that, well, you know, I used to struggle with this, but I'd say, I'm not really an actor. I'm not really a stand-up. I'm not really a sketch player. What am I? I know that I'm kind of funny when I just am myself, and I know that I like to interact with people, and I love to be in small comedy bits. And basically, I ended up probably getting the one job that I'd be qualified to do, which is a little bit of everything.
My guest is Conan O'Brien, who just celebrated his third anniversary as the host of Late Night. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Conan O'Brien. You took tap dance lessons when you were 9 years old.
That's right.
That was your idea to take them?
Yeah. No, it was not forced upon me by anybody. That's the sad part. I think the story is much less frightening when you say, well, my parents made me. But it's scary to think that a 9-year-old boy says, Mom, Dad, I want to be a tap dancer. You think, what is with this kid? But I
find it really endearing that a 9-year-old would want to learn a form that's become pretty archaic.
Well, see, it's very funny because I had a very archaic... I knew when I was very young that I wanted to be in show business.
Uh-huh.
And my view of show business was based on the movies that they ran on Channel 56, which is the UHF station in Boston, or was the UHF station in Boston when I was growing up. And they used to show movies from the 40s, like Yankee Doodle Dandy and On the Town. You know, they would show these movies, and as this little kid, I didn't have a sense of, well, this movie was made a long time ago. I didn't know. I'm still to this day not that bright, but I would watch these movies like Yankee Doodle Dandy with Jimmy Cagney.
And, I grew up on that too.
Yeah, and he's like singing and dancing and tap dancing, and I thought, if you want to be in show business, you got to be able to have, you know, tell a joke, put a song across, but most importantly, you have to be able to break into a 10-minute tap dance at any moment. And so I went right to my parents and said, I got to take tap dancing lessons. And they, you know, they considered that for a few days. And they said, all right, he really wants to do it. So they hooked me up with a guy named Stanley Brown, who's since passed away, but he was this older black gentleman who had been the protege of Bill Bojangles Robinson, the great tap dancer who'd been in all those Shirley Temple movies. So I really got hooked up with the master. And I remembered I was this 9-year-old, really pale, round-faced kid with bright, bright orange hair who would, my dad would drop me off on his way to work on Saturday mornings. He'd drop me off in a part of Boston that's right near the Berklee School of Music, and I would walk up this like rickety old 10 flights of steps into his dance studio, and then it would be all 25, 24-year-old black men and women, and then one like orange-haired, freckled kid sitting there holding his shoes in a box. And I would study, and I did that for a number of years until Stanley Brown passed away, and then I got this huge growth spurt. I grew to 6'4" in like a day. It was like I was irradiated or something. I grew very tall and lost all my coordination, and just sort of it fell by the wayside.
Did you have a nice sense of rhythm when you were 9?
Since we're on radio, I'll just say yes, I did. And have,
right.
Of course, I don't have to back it up. Yes, I did. And by the way, I'm extremely handsome right now, for those of you who can't see me.
You know, your sense of show business, I think this is maybe parodied a little bit on a sketch of the Jerry Lewis telethon.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come on and you're singing Consider Yourself from Oliver.
Yeah, we basically took footage of Jerry Lewis introducing an act on his telethon and then dropped my voice in so that it looks like Jerry Lewis is introducing a wonderful new talent, Conan O'Brien, and then you cut to me and we match the studio so it looks like I'm right there. And I'm wearing a gold tuxedo jacket, and I and a bow tie, a sparkling bow tie, and the band kicks in "Consider Yourself" from Oliver, and I go into this really over the top version of "Consider Yourself," and then we cut to actual footage of Jerry Lewis wincing, so it looks like, and we cut to the board with all the tallies and the totals for the telethon donations is actually plummeting. It's actually going backwards.
Now, did you think when you were 9 that you'd actually be on the telethon in a gaudy suit singing Consider Yourself? Was that your idea of what the future would be as an entertainer?
Yeah, I think that was my... I used to do... I think like a lot of people that later to go on to be performers, I used to do... I would host a television show in front of the mirror on the first floor of my house. That mirror, the mirror is still there. But I would stand in front of the mirror and I would say, "Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the program. Good to have you here." And I would invite my guests on. It was always, my brother and my sister. And they were actually very good shows. We got top guests back then in front of the mirror. We had Tom Cruise on when he was 8. So,
did you sing on your show?
I had this very corny, antiquated idea of what show business is, and I think actually you can see there's an element of that on the show that I do now on the late night show. Is there is kind of like a lot of singing and performing and puppets and we do a lot of that kind of show business. There are elements of the show that really are sort of from a bygone era.
Well, I think your show has the best late night theme.
Oh,
music
thanks.
Theme. Yeah, I really like it a lot.
I like that theme, yeah.
Yeah, now did you have a theme for your show in front of the mirror?
I think we just put on a record, whatever record was around. So it was, it was probably some record my parents had. But yeah, we had like, 76. I used to think like, that song 70, I think my this is before I could go out and buy records of my own.
76
I mean?
Trombones.
Yeah, so you'd have to use your parents' records. And so obviously it was records that I would not go out and buy by myself. It was like the Glenn Miller Orchestra, but and then the minute I had the ability to go out and buy records on my own, the theme changed. But
so what else was in your parents' record collection? The Music Man.
They had fortunately one thing they had is they had my father was a fan of comedy, so they had Bill Cosby. Mm-hmm. Albums, and I think I think there's already a generation gap. I'm 33 years old, but when I meet people in their 20s, or early 20s or late teens, they don't really know what a comedy album is, or they're not as familiar with it. I think that kind of went out of style. You know, there are people today like Adam Sandler who do comedy albums that are really funny and popular, but back then it was a much bigger thing. And my parents had Bob Newhart comedy albums and Bill Cosby and David Fry. You know, they would have doing Richard Nixon and I, you know, we used to put these records on at night. That was the big like treat. It's like on a Sunday night you could put the record on, and then my bedroom was right, you know, was not too far from the record player. You could then listen, like as you were going to sleep, to Bill Cosby, and I knew those records by heart.
Did you used to watch Johnny Carson when you were growing up?
Yeah, I did. My father was, as I said, he was always a big fan of comedy, and he was a big Johnny Carson fan. He loved Karnak, and he loved Floyd Turbo, and my father really loved the interplay between Johnny and Ed. You know, when you know, Johnny would, when Ed would say, "Right in that envelope, sir, in that very envelope contains the essence of," you know, and he would go on like that, and then Carson would say, "Wrong again," you know, whatever. I don't remember the actual lines, but the whole interplay, my father had a real ear and has a real ear for what's funny. And so he would, I would watch with my dad, and, you know, I can remember quite clearly, you know, sitting in the, you know, getting to stay up late and watch Carson. And, you know, he's still to this day in the late night wars. And I think, you know, everybody pretty readily concedes that Johnny's kind of the model. You know, everything's it's the Model T from which everything else is just a variation. And you know, they're you probably will not see that again. I don't think the way TV's structured these days, you know, there won't be another guy who reigns like that for 30 years, I don't think, and has that much of a universal impact.
Conan O'Brien is the host of Late Night. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Vintage Books, paperback publishers of A Civil Action by Jonathan Haar. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the emergency guest. We continue our conversation with Late Night's Conan O'Brien. Also, In Search of the Erotic Foot, we talk with novelist Jeff Nicholson about his new novel, Footsucker, The Confessions of a Foot Fetishist. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Conan O'Brien, who just celebrated his third anniversary on the air. Until late night, he was best known as a writer. He'd written for The Simpsons, Saturday Night Live, and had been president of the Harvard Lampoon. I asked him about his Harvard days. How serious were you about classes? You majored in, I think, English literature and American history?
Yeah, American history and literature. Probably. I mean, I wasn't a goof off. I mean, you know, you'd never know I'm a you know, goofy late night talk show host now. But I actually wrote a thesis when I was in my senior year at Harvard called "Literary Progeria in the Works of William Faulkner and Flannery O'Connor."
What is a progeria?
Progeria, it's this idea I had, and now all your listeners will go to sleep. In a nutshell, progeria is that disease that kids get, very rare disease that ages them instant, you know,
oh,
overnight.
Oh, yeah, right.
And so I sort of said that there's this thing called literary progeria where children are portrayed as prematurely old in literature, and I thought it was a device that you could see in Southern literature that because of the unique experience of the South, meaning that they had suffered this great defeat in a country that's only known for victory, that their children in especially Flannery O'Connor's literature seem old before their time. That's it in a nutshell. One professor bought it, one professor didn't, and I made it out of Harvard with an okay grade. But, you know, it's a bit of a juggling act. But now I look back on that now and I think, God, that sounds so serious, you know? This wasn't necessary. I've basically become Montel Williams. What was I doing that? What was I doing that for? The hell? I could have been drinking.
Conan O'Brien is my guest. So you know what I really wish Fresh Air could borrow from your show?
Okay, go ahead.
The emergency guest.
Oh, yeah. I know. I think every show would like one of those.
Every show would like one. Why don't you describe it in case some of our listeners
Emergency guest is, and we haven't done it in a while, but it was a bit that I always really liked, where we come back from commercial and I say to Andy, the guest we were supposed to have right now, William Shatner, his car broke down on the way from the airport. He's not going to be here. We don't have a second guest. And then he would say, well, Conan, there's just one thing we can do. We got to use the emergency guest. And I go, you're right, old friend. And we cross over to the side of the stage, and there's a big glass box that says break in case of emergency. And inside is a mannequin wearing a tuxedo. And we smash the glass. Andy takes the giant mannequin out, puts it in the guest seat. I press a button, and it goes, hello there. I am your emergency guest. And then it continues to talk. It talks just like a phony Hollywood celebrity. It starts to say things like, please don't ask me about my relationship with Cher. That's strictly personal. We've got to help the rainforest. If we don't do something, who will? Planet Hollywood is opening up. I have one in Cairo. I hope you'll all be able to check it out. I'm really excited about my new movie. And then the running joke is, I try and talk, and he cuts me off and says, show my clip, show my clip, show my clip, show my clip. So I go, okay, here's the emergency guest's clip, and we roll a clip. And it's a real movie clip that we made starring the mannequin. So you'll see the mannequin riding a horse, and you'll see actors shooting at it. And they really got involved. I mean, we started to do emergency guests where he'd say, show my clip, and we'd show the clip, and it would be a scene where we'd get Eli Wallach. I mean, we'd get, like, real heavy hitters to be in this, and they're yelling at the emergency guest in this one scene I remember is dressed as a boxer, and he's in the locker room, and Eli Wallach is there, turning in this great performance saying, you've got to do it, kid. You got to go out there. And then we'd shoot a boxing sequence with the mannequin, and so I always loved that because that bit always went farther than you thought it would. And I remember the thing that excited me most when I was a young TV viewer was when you got more than you thought you were going to get. If you know, when you were watching SCTV, when you were watching Johnny Carson, and the bit had more layers to it than you expected, mm-hmm. It was this real excitement. Like, my God, they went to a lot of – now the camera's following him outside and – you know, there's more to this than I thought there was going to be. This isn't just the garden variety bit. And that was a bit where I knew if I was 16 or 17 and I was watching Emergency Guest, the fact that he actually had a clip and that it starred Eli Wallach and that the Emergency Guest is doing a stunt on a horse would blow me away. I'd be really excited.
Conan O'Brien, what a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much, and congratulations on your success with Late Night.
Oh, thanks for, yeah, thanks for having me.
Conan O'Brien is the host of NBC's Late Night.
I'm referring to a singer who is now entering his fifth decade as a performer. And is he hot? All the young people are now finding out what all the older people found out when they first heard him, and now he has a whole new audience, and so does he deserve this.
Conan O'Brien, ladies and gentlemen.
Coming up, the confessions of a foot fetishist. This is Fresh Air. Jeff Nicholson is an English writer who writes about people with unusual obsessions. Still Life with Volkswagens was about VW collectors. Hunters and Gatherers is about eccentrics who collect all sorts of unusual and pointless things. Nicholson's new novel, Footsucker, is the confessions of a foot fetishist, an otherwise ordinary man whose passionate longings center around his search for the perfect erotic foot. In satirizing one man's obsessions, Nicholson also satirizes the sexual preoccupations of the larger culture. Here's a short reading.
I realize, of course, that laying down laws for female beauty is an absurd and dangerous occupation. And if I sound dogmatic and impossibly demanding, all I can say is sorry, but that's how it is with fetishes. Of course, feet that do not conform to my ideal have every right to exist, have every right to be admired. Indeed, I myself have admired and been intimate with feet that were a long way from perfect. Nevertheless, a man knows what he wants. And in one sense, I am being descriptive rather than prescriptive. For, as I describe my idea of the perfect foot, I find that I am very precisely describing Catherine's. But the perfect foot is not bare. It is shod. The shoe delivers a vital aesthetic transformation. It customizes a part of the body. Whereas the perfect foot allows only one possibility, there are an infinite number of shoes that may be admired and enjoyed. And finding the right shoe is the comparatively easy part. Shoes can be bought. They can be specially made, whereas the perfect foot is a natural phenomenon like the Grand Canyon or the Victoria Falls. Of course, shoes need to be high-heeled. The higher the better, within reason. I don't personally feel any need to psychoanalyze the high heel, but undoubtedly it makes women stand and walk differently. It raises their buttocks, it makes them wiggle, it makes them look dominant, but at the same time it makes them quite vulnerable. It is hard for them to run away.
Jeff Nicholson, what got you thinking about fetishism and foot fetishism in particular?
I suppose a lifetime's vague interest. I suppose when I began writing this book, I did wonder if I was a foot fetishist, a foot and shoe fetishist. Having spent a year living inside the head of my character, I became fairly convinced that I wasn't. But let's just say that in the sense that there are leg men and breast men, I've always been a bit of a foot man.
Why?
I don't know. How can we determine what we love? Someone said that, didn't they? I mean, that's the way it is with fetishes. Something gets you, and you're not sure why, but it gets you where you live. It hits those mental erogenous zones.
So you've written a very extreme version of something much more mild that you were experiencing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I am, and I think what probably most men are, and this is explained in the book, is that I'm a partialist. And I suspect that certainly most men, and I suspect probably most women as well, are partialists, that, you know, you have a certain range of erotic preference, you know, that some people are turned on by tight buttocks and some people are turned on by hairy chests, in the case of men or women. And some men, you know, like big breasts, some men are turned on by small breasts. I think that men are probably better at women at saying they want a specific quality. But I think we all do it to some extent. Now, the difference between the partialist and the fetishist is that the partialist can live with a woman or a man who doesn't submit, who doesn't conform exactly to those needs, whereas a fetishist wouldn't be remotely interested in you if you had anything other than those tight buttocks, the hairy chest, or in the case of the feet and the shoes. A foot fetishist wouldn't care what the rest of the woman looked like. He would only be sexually interested in her feet. And in extreme cases, although this is very much not the character in my book, there'd be men who sit at home with a collection of shoes and find that every bit as satisfying as sitting there with a woman.
Now, as your character points out, foot fetishism is the fetish that people laugh at. It doesn't have the danger and the sense of consequence of, say, sadomasochism or a compulsive attraction to animals.
Yeah, I mean, I'm, for my sins, I guess, a comic writer, or at least a writer who uses comedy. And but it's always slightly dark comedy. It's always comedy with a bit of edge. And I think I probably always write about people who are obsessives in some way. And obviously sex is an area where there's a lot of scope for obsession. And yes, I mean, I could have written about someone who was into pain or into animals or whatever. But I just kind of feel that there's a major kind of problem in that it's very hard to make someone like that sympathetic. I mean, I think you however kind of liberal you are, you probably think there's something, you know, a bit wrong there, something going wrong psychologically. Whereas my hero in Footsucker, it was very important to me that he was an ordinary guy, a very ordinary guy who lived a kind of ordinary life, who was, you know, just like us, and had this sexual peculiarity that in fact didn't bother him, that enabled him to lead a more or less normal life, that it was a kind of, it informed his life, but it didn't twist his life, it didn't knock it out of shape.
One of the things I really like about your style of writing in this novel is that the character is involved with something that's basically very irrational, an obsessive dedication to women's feet. But he uses a very rational, logical way of always trying to explain what his obsession is about and trying to logically and rationally categorize and differentiate between the different kinds of feet. And that gap between the irrationality of his obsession and the logic in which he tries to explain it is really very funny.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I had never thought of it in precisely that way. I mean, he is aware that there's something irrational in his obsession. I mean, he is kind of simultaneously inside and outside the obsession. He is able to look at it. And he is aware that some people would find this a bit odd. But I think that business of classification and, as you say, listing the qualities and the kind of rational dissection of the obsession, that seems to be something that's quite familiar in obsessive characters. I mean, what we in England call train spotters. I mean, people who want to list and classify. That whole business of people who collect, who divide the world up into types and into forms. That seems to me. It seemed to me right. That seemed to be the kind of thing he would be doing. As an actual technique, I never sat down and thought, yes, he must be rational in order to explain his irrationality. But, yeah, I mean, it's obviously true.
So did you do research for the book where you track down fetishists and talk with them and read fetish magazines and so on?
Well, yeah, I mean, at the boring end, you know, I went along to the library and read Kraft Ebbing and that kind of stuff. You don't have to go very far at all before you find a woman who's encountered a reasonably extreme kind of foot fetishism. My wife, in fact, was she was in Shepherd's Bush, coming home from work one day, and she had an experience very much like the opening of the book. That's where that's stolen from. She was stopped by an innocuous, pleasant young man in a suit with a clipboard, who said that he wanted to ask her a few questions about shoes and foot matters, claiming that he was from, I think a health and safety company, doing some kind of market research. And by the end of the interview, he was kind of scrabbling on the ground, trying to grab her shoes and sniff them. I mean, he was turned on by the smell, I think, rather than by the look. But I've spoken to women who've had their shoes stolen on the bus, of men who tried to not to rape them, but to sort of drag them into cars and steal their high heels. Our hero here is completely unthreatening and undangerous in that way. I've met quite a few women who've had some sort of, slightly violent encounters with shoe and foot fetishism as its center.
Let me tell you what I think might have been an encounter I had with a foot fetishist. I got a phone call from somebody who said he was making an independent movie and that he'd seen a publicity photo of me and he really liked the shoes I was wearing. They were like little lace-up boots. Wow. And that they really needed these particular shoes for their actress who was playing the leading role in the movie, and no other shoes would do. These shoes were just so cool. And I thought, this is really strange, and obviously did not send them my boots.
Well, I mean, one of the strange things about shoes and boots is that although on the one hand they keep their shape even when they're not being worn, they also, even when they're not being worn, they still contain sort of the design of your foot. I mean, the sweat and the way that the foot becomes slightly, the way the shoe becomes slightly moulded to the sense of the shape of the foot. I think you should be proud.
I think I should be proud. Okay. What does your wife think about this new book and about your interest in feet?
Well, I mean, it's a very strange one because I would say that when I was writing this book, I thought, men are going to get it and women aren't. And I think that virtually exactly the opposite has happened. I mean, my wife is perfectly comfortable about it. I mean, she knows that I'm a sicko, and that goes with being married to a writer anyway. But, a lot of men have said to me, I just don't get this foot shoe thing. But it's my experience that all women do. And somehow maybe women are used to being fetishized. They're used to men who are obsessive in some way or another. Whereas a lot of men are still in denial about it. They're trying to say, I don't know anything about that dreadful fetishistic business.
You have written a lot about people who are obsessive. I mean, your new novel is somebody who's an obsessive foot fetishist. You have an earlier novel about somebody who's obsessive about Volkswagens. Another novel that's somebody who is writing about people who are obsessive collectors.
Yeah.
What's your interest in obsession as a writer?
I suppose there's a slight feeling of there, but for the grace of God go I. I suppose I do understand train spotters. I do understand the need to be inclusive, to gather to you things that for security, that this desire to be in control of the world. And I think in the end I just draw back. I say, hold on, it's madness. There is no reason to have 97 different kinds of salt shaker. There's no reason to fill your scrapbook with thousands of pictures of women's feet. But I'm enough of a collector, enough of an obsessive to see why people do it. I mean, I guess my real obsession is with writing, and it seems to me, in a sense, that that's doing the same. I mean, that if collectors are trying to establish control over a world, to make the world in their own image, to kind of make their own sets of rules, well, that's very, very much what one does as a novelist.
Do you collect things?
I amass things. I mean, I mean, like everyone else, I have records and books and stuff. The only thing that I save, and it started as a joke, and it's now become, I suppose, rather a bad joke, is model Volkswagens. When I wrote my first novel, which was called Street Sleeper, which is about Volkswagens, I bought a couple of Volkswagens for myself, little toy, dinky toys. And then somebody else, went on a holiday and bought me two or three more. And, it's now into the hundreds. And I'm still saying, no, I'm not a collector.
You have hundreds of Volkswagen cars?
Toys, not the real thing.
Oh, toy models of cars.
Models of cars, yeah, dinky toys. Otherwise,
we would have needed a parking lot at this point.
Right, no, dinky toys is obviously an English reference, sorry. Oh. But I don't collect women's shoes.
My guest is Jeff Nicholson, author of the new novel Foot Sucker. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jeff Nicholson, his new novel, Foot Sucker, is written in the form of the confessions of a foot fetishist. You once said this, I think when people are alone in their room with the curtains closed, they do amazingly interesting things. And you said, but your editor said, no, when people are alone in their room, what they do is they turn on the TV.
Yeah.
But is this what interests you about people, what they do when they're alone in their own room with the shades down and the door closed?
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably... It may come from being an only child, which is what I am. And I certainly always like talking to people on a kind of one-to-one basis rather than being in groups, whereas obviously an awful lot of the history of literature is about how people react in social situations. I think I'm always more interested in people once they get outside of social situations. I think my editor in that little quote probably he would say in answer to my objections that people may not be most themselves when they're alone, that in fact it's when they exist as social creatures that they actually become mostly themselves. But I'm very interested in what people are like when they stop putting on an act, and I tend to believe that. Particularly in the area of sexuality, once you're alone and alone, in your own head with your own thoughts and fantasies, that is absolutely what you are.
I think your writing is pretty funny. You have you say this about comics in one of your earlier novels. You write, "I've always admired stand-up comedians. The work they do is brave, lonely, difficult, and absurd. I don't think there's anything absurd about entertaining people and trying to make them laugh, but there is something absurd about only trying to make people laugh." Do you believe that about comedy?
I suppose I do. I've known a number of stand-up comedians in my time, not very famous ones, but moderately successful ones, guys who could get up and work a room. And all that stuff is true about how difficult and lonely and brave it is. And a bit of me sometimes thinks... Maybe I could do that because, I do readings and I can entertain a room full of people, by reading from my book. And I've talked to comedians and said, well, what's it about? And they say, if you don't have to do it, you won't do it. Because if it's not a need, you're never going to get up there and do it. It's psychologically in the genes. But in my time, I've written for TV comedy shows, And getting up in the morning and saying, well, I have to write 5 jokes by 4 o'clock today. I mean, it's at least as, it's the hardest thing there is. It's at least as hard as writing 2 pages of serious dialogue. And I always felt at the end of the day it wasn't actually that satisfying. I mean, I suppose there's a bit of, literary snobbery or something in that.
It seems to me in some way you're writing about the more absurd parts of the human condition by looking at how people relate to their own obsessions and to pop culture. And that's where your humor comes in.
I guess that's so. I mean, for obvious reasons, I try not to to define it, because I think the moment I started knowing what I was doing, I'd probably stop being able to do it. I've never consciously, certainly not since my first or second book, I've never consciously thought I could do with a joke here. I mean, some people have certainly said Footsucker is not nearly as funny a book as some of my earlier things. I kind of think, well, that's fine too. I never really set out to write a rip-roaring comedy. I just set out to write the books that I could. And, I don't want to be that kind of clown who wants to play Hamlet or wants to write Hamlet. But me, right from the beginning, I've written what I've written. And it's good if you find it funny, but it still works if you don't, I think. I mean, there's a sufficient element of seriousness about the stories and about the characters that it still works even if you don't find it hilarious.
What do you think people will think of you as the author of Footsucker, that assumptions then will make about who you are and what your personal life is like?
Well, obviously, if I cared too passionately about that, I guess I'd never written the book in the first place. But, yeah, I mean, obviously, you write books about murderers and thieves. I don't think I've ever written about a rapist. But nobody comes up to you the next day and says, hey, are you a murderer, are you a thief, are you a rapist? But, write a book about foot and shoe fetishism, and it's everybody's first question. As I said at the beginning, I'm a partialist, not a fetishist, but I don't know. I mean, I suspect I'm a terrible disappointment to people, and I suspect that most authors are. I mean, that one's energy and one's weirdness and one's sexiness gets directed into the novel, and the poor miserable person who's left behind is a pale shadow of the art. And I think that's the way it ought to be.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Jeff Nicholson's new novel is called Footsucker. I'm Terry Gross.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a-messin' where you shouldn't have been a-messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Yeah.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.